This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Alice Siebold, has written her first new novel since The Lovely Bones, which was a critical and popular success and stayed on the New York Times bestseller list for over a year. Her new novel, The Almost Moon, has what I think is the most quoted opening sentence of any novel this year. I'll read it to you. When all is said and done, killing my mother came easy. That's the voice of the main character, Helen, a divorced mother of two in her 40s who had been taking care of her mother for 20 years. When the novel opens, her mother is elderly and suffering with dementia. After that first section, when Helen snaps, the rest of the novel, which plays out over the next 24 hours, reveals what brought Helen to take her mother's life. Reviewing The Almost Moon in Time magazine, Lev Grossman wrote, "Nobody makes things easy on Helen. Certainly Siebold doesn't. Siebold's unblinking authorial gaze is her hallmark, where lesser writers would turn away from things too horrible to see or feel or admit. Her scrutiny never wavers." Alice Siebold, welcome back to Fresh Air. I'd like to start with a reading from the beginning of the book. Would you read from it for us?
When all is said and done, killing my mother came easily. Dementia, as it descends, has a way of revealing the core of the person affected by it. My mother's core was rotten, like the brackish water at the bottom of a weeks-old vase of flowers. She had been beautiful when my father met her, and still capable of love when I became their late-in-life child. But by the time she gazed up at me that day, none of this mattered. If I hadn't picked up my ringing phone, Mrs. Castle, my mother's unlucky neighbor, would have continued down the list of emergency numbers posted on my mother's almond-colored fridge. But within the hour, I found myself rushing over to the house where I was born. It was a cool October morning. When I arrived, my mother was sitting upright in her wing chair, wrapped in a mohair shawl and mumbling to herself. Mrs. Castle said my mother hadn't recognized her that morning when she'd brought the paper to the door. "She tried to slam the door on me," Mrs. Castle said. "She screamed like I was scalding her. It was the most pitiful thing imaginable." My mother sat, a totemic presence, in the flocked red and white wing chair in which she'd spent more than two decades since my father's death. She'd aged slowly in that chair, retiring first to read books and work her needlepoint, and then, when her eyes began to fail, to watch public television from dawn until she fell asleep in front of it after her evening meal. In the last year or two, she would sit in the chair and not even bother to turn on the television. Often she placed the twisted skeins of yarn that my older daughter Emily still sent each Christmas in the center of her lap. She petted them the way some old women might pet cats. I thanked Mrs. Castle and assured her I would handle everything. "Mother," I said, calling the name only I, as her sole child, had the right to call her. She looked up at me and smiled. "Bitch," she said. The thing about dementia is that sometimes you feel like the afflicted person has a tripwire to the truth, as if they can see beneath the skin you hide in. "Mother, it's Helen," I said. "I know who you are," she barked at me. Her hands clasped the curved ends of the armrests, and I could see how hard she pressed, her anger flaring up and out at me like involuntary claws. "That's good," I said. I stood there a moment longer, until it felt like an established fact. She was my mother, and I was her daughter. I thought we could go forward from this into our usual unpleasant encounter.
That's Alice Siebold reading from her new novel, The Almost Moon. You know, but this encounter goes beyond the usual unpleasant encounter. The daughter kills her mother. Can you explain what puts her over the edge?
In my mind, it really is. It's the accumulation of the years of their relationship, and also the years of being both the dutiful daughter and also the secret agent, as it were, the hiding agent. One of the major forces at work in the book is this idea of what goes on in the internal world behind the door of the house in the suburbs and how that's represented in the external world. So for a large part of the book, trying to keep up appearances is a huge thing. And even part of what happens as Helen is in the first chapter, she's trying to wash her mother to make her look good for the hospice workers or the hospital workers who come to pick her up. Things go wrong, but she wants her to look good, the presentation, all of that. And I think there's this kind of toxic storm for Helen finally, and she ends up killing her mother.
And I should say, like, the last straw here is, like, the mother loses control of her bowels and soils herself, and Helen, the daughter, wants to clean her up before calling the ambulance, and it's just impossible for her to take her mother to a place where she can clean her, and that's just kind of like the last straw for her. It's what puts her over the edge. You know, the first line of the book is being quoted by everybody. It's, "When all is said and done, killing my mother came easily." Was that the first line that came to you when you started writing the book? Like, when was that line written?
That line was written when I finally had Helen, but it took me about 2.5 years to find Helen. I wrote the book from her ex-husband's point of view in the third person. I wrote the book from one of her daughter's points of view in the first person and then in the third person. And this is my process, which is it takes me a very long time to find the right voice to tell the story that I want to tell. And so by the time I'm ready, by the time I have that voice, it's almost as if all the fat has been cut off of. There's no preamble. It's just, you know, game on, start. And so it was the first line I wrote once I had Helen's voice.
You know, what's especially alarming as you read this novel is that, you know, this is a period when so many people are taking care of elderly parents, parents with dementia or, you know, any other number of problems. And there's always a moment when your frustration with a parent's stubbornness or with their dependence, or with the way they boss you around, even though you're making such a sacrifice in your life to be with them, that it can make you momentarily furious. And what you've done is taken that frustration all the way.
Right. Exactly. It's just that one step over the line, as it were. I have both been in the room with and heard the stories of people who have been right on that other side, that safe side of that line. But in the case of this novel, I just take it right over onto the other side.
Well, it's kind of upsetting as a reader because, you know, you're identifying with some of Helen's frustrations, but it's appalling, you know, that she would that she would kill her mother. Why did you want to take her over the line, like beyond?
I think it allowed, within the context of the novel, for me to explore so many things about our relationship to our parents and to a sense of identity on the planet. Like, you know, what our identity really is made from. Is it made from the relationship to the parent? Is it made from the parent? Is it made from a moral duty to the parent? You know, who's the good child, who's the bad child, all of that. And that is another thing I see a lot in the caretaking setup, which is there can be the child who pays for everything, but then there's the child who actually goes to the hospital all the time. But when the parent is actually gone, in this case, by Helen's own hands, when the parent is actually gone, this vacuum happens. People have to look around and kind of figure out who they are without that defining, almost magnet force of the parent still on the planet.
There's something going on here more than your average mother-daughter tension. Why did you want to make the mother mentally ill and again, take it beyond the step of the kind of normal realm of mother-daughter tension?
It wasn't even necessarily a want or a conscious thing. I mean, that's a kind of an obsession of mine, just the idea of how mental illness in a family perverts and shapes a family, and particularly the children in it. And what I'd say is there are all sorts of dramatic mental illnesses that maybe get all the copy, as it were. But then there are there are tons of families out there where there's the more mundane and insidious and deforming day by day a parent or both parents who have mental illness and really shape the life of a family. And so that's an obsession that went in combination with the characters and their situation.
I think it's often hard for daughters to break away from their mothers. But in the case of your novel, it's particularly hard for Helen because, you know, after her father dies, Helen is left as her mother's caregiver, and she feels like there's no breaking away, and she says she feels her mother sucking the life out of her. You've described the novel as a novel about self-erasure, you know, because Helen gives up her identity as well as her much of her life to take care of her mother. Why did you want to write about that?
I think I was drawn to write about it because I feel like I see it happening almost everywhere. I know quite a few women who are in that position, and I also am very kind of heartbroken by the reality that because people are living to a later age now, more and more women who thought that, well, they'll have their life or they'll do this or they'll do that after they've watched or helped their parents to a good death. You know, in my mother's own case, her mother was 96 when she died. My mother was in her 70s. That's not given her a lot of time on this planet, you know, to live free without that dutiful responsibility of being the good daughter who drops everything to take care of her mother. And, you know, that's a particular burden, and it's one that falls and is assumed to fall rightly on the daughter. And when I was doing a lot of tour for my previous novel, I saw this in all the countries that I went to. Older mothers would come with their daughters who were also old. And it just seemed to be something I was seeing everywhere and kind of was really struck by the idea that they were aging together and not always in the best of circumstances. So,
if you're just joining us, my guest is Alice Sebold. She's the author of The Lovely Bones, which is a huge and longtime bestseller, and of the memoir Lucky. Her new book is the novel The Almost Moon. Now, you know, as we've said, you know, the mother who the main character kills in frustration is mentally ill. In your memoir Lucky, you described how your mother suffered with panic attacks and for a few years alcoholism. And you describe her as having flaps. She says, and you say, flaps were our name for when mommy went crazy. Describe an example of a flap.
I feel a little, my mother will be listening to this. A flap basically was when she was unable to function. And I think I'll leave it at that just because I feel more comfortable writing about those things in a more particular context within the control of my prose than to describe my mother's particular problems in detail on the radio. But it's when she became unable to function.
You know, and in saying that, it makes me think that, like, when you're a writer, you have to... I think it was John le Carré who said that writers have to have, like, a chip of ice in the center of their hearts because you end up having to say things that you wouldn't necessarily want to say in public or to somebody's face, but to get to, like, larger truths about characters, you have to say
right.
things that are not necessarily possible.
Well, you would prefer not
to... Right, yeah.
You would prefer not to cause pain to...
Exactly.
To other people, but sometimes for the sake of what you're working on, you end up causing pain.
Why are you more willing to cause pain? This is a really obvious question, so forgive me for asking it, but why are you more willing to cause that pain in the pages of your book than you are, say, in public discourse on the radio?
Because I'm a writer, not a speaker. And it's something that I can think over and deliberate over. I think that's why.
Yeah, and I didn't mean that in such a way. It's like, why won't you tell us?
No, I understand.
Just like there's a difference, and I was curious to see how you would define that. Are you worried that your mother will take your new book personally in the sense, like, she'd be in the position of saying, yes, it's a wonderful new book about a daughter who kills her mother?
Well, my mom, I mean, I have to say I'm very lucky. I mean, I use that word a lot. I'm very lucky in that my parents both believe strongly in the written word, and so they could put up with a lot. But the first thing my mother did when she read the book was she called me and she said, there are some people who are going to need to put real people to fictional characters. I'm not one of them. I'm a reader. This is a good book. So she's pretty awesome in that way. She can transcend past the fictional references and read the novel.
My guest is Alice Siebold. Her new novel, The Almost Moon, is about a woman in her 40s named Helen who snaps and kills her elderly mother after having taken care of her for years. Elderly mother who has dementia and other medical problems, and Helen is the caretaker. And Helen kind of goes over the line. Helen kills her mother. Helen goes over the line in another way, too. And I hope I'm not giving away too much here, but Helen sleeps with her best friend's adult son. Now, that is something I would imagine a lot of women have maybe fantasized about for a moment or two, but Helen crosses the line and actually does it. And I guess I'm interested in why you wanted your character to cross the line in that territory, too.
Well, for me, I think, again, I always feel that all actions in my novels are motivated by the character, and I have very little control. That both sounds ridiculous because, of course, I'm writing it, but it is the force of personality of my main characters, at least upon me, is great enough so that I do feel that's true. But I will say it makes sense to me that she would go from the death of her mother to this extremely life-affirming, or if not life-affirming, an experience of pure life, even if it is taboo and then going to cause all sorts of trouble, to sleep with her best friend's son. She does not go seeking him out. She goes to seek her best friend and instead finds him. It's warmth, it's humanity, it's love, and she takes it where you would take it, with a beautiful man who makes himself available in a moment of vulnerability. So it seems very natural to me.
Your book is in some ways kind of like a thriller because it starts with a murder. Then Helen has to figure out what to do with the body. And then there's all kinds of consequences. And you don't know, I mean, you don't know if she's going to be discovered, if she's going to try to cover up the crime. You just have no idea what's going to happen. But at the same time, a lot of the novel is what's going on in Helen's mind, what she's thinking, what her memories are, the kind of mental associations she's going through in the 24 hours that the novel takes place. And I think that's what makes it such a kind of literary work, because it's so reflective, even though if you were just to look at the plot, it's a thriller. Mm, do you feel like you're combining two genres in a way?
I think so. I mean, there's just something for me that is freaking out about how ever more split, and I know it's for the sake of marketing and the way the world works now, ever more split we are with the way books are, you know, shelved and formatted, the way their covers look different, all of that. But I want a muscular book that keeps me reading but that makes me think and is written in a way that respects my intelligence. And you know, maybe that's too long to put on a genre card in a bookstore, but that's what I want to read, and that's what I'm trying to write. Something propulsive that is driven by the brain as much as it's driven by you know, the actions, the physical actions of the characters. So it's a combo pack that I'm trying to work with.
What's the process of writing like for you? Do you know when where you're headed? Like you said that you wrote the novel at first from the points of view of different characters before realizing that you were going to write it from Helen's point of view. Hmm. Once you knew you were writing it from Helen's point of view, did it come easily? Do analogies come easily for you? Did you have to write a lot of drafts once you were writing it in Helen's point of view?
Once I have the voice, I feel like it may take me a very long time, but it's like having a friend. I mean, you know, again, that sounds gross, but it's true. You know, once I found Susie for The Lovely Bones and once I found Helen for The Almost Moon, I felt like, okay, here we are, we're going. And so it can then take me quite a long time to write it, or I'll write chapters, or I'll go in directions that I then ultimately throw out. But I know I've got my suit on and I'm going to end up somewhere. I have a confidence that I did not have in those previous versions, where the voices before, they feel like an infallible cocktail party, but they don't feel rigorous. It doesn't feel real. You know, it's perfectly competent, but it doesn't push me or excite me, and I don't feel like I'm going to be driven into dark territory. And so I get bored by my own work. And so if that's the case, why would I want to finish out that book and share it with people? So as soon as I've got the voice, then I feel just well suited to take on the challenge. I don't know how long the challenge is going to take me, but I feel good about it.
I'd like you to read the passage that the title comes from. This explains the title. And just to remind our listeners, the mother in this novel is agoraphobic and has some dementia now, but has had some mental illness over the years. And in this passage, Helen's father, this passage is a memory of years ago when Helen's father was describing something about her mother.
"I like to think your mother is almost whole," he said. "So much in life is about almost, not quite. Like the moon," I said. "There it hung, a thin slice, still low in the sky." "Right," he said. "The moon is whole all the time, but we can't always see it. What we see is an almost moon, or a not quite moon. The rest is hiding, just out of view. But there's only one moon, so we follow it in the sky. We plan our lives based on its rhythms and tides." "Right." I knew I was supposed to understand something from my father's explanation, but what I came away with was that, just as we were stuck with the moon, so too we were stuck with my mother. Wherever I'd travel, there she'd be.
How did you come up with this image and title of the almost moon?
You know, it's funny. Sometimes there are things that come early and you just know that they are overarching symbols or ideas for the book. And I knew, just as bones were important to the Lovely Bones, I knew that the moon and the idea of it never really leaving, you know, even when the sun is up, obviously the moon is still there, was going to be important in combination with the idea of the domineering mother. And when I say domineering, I mean not literally in the moment of action, but that she is the major person who shapes the life of Helen. So the moon is a constant, as is the mother a constant.
You know, in the beginning of the novel, you describe dementia as often revealing the core of the person. And you say that the person with dementia, it's as if they were a tripwire to the truth when they speak.
Mm.
How do you know that? Like, what has given you the experience of that?
Just different experiences that I've had and that I've seen. And, you know, we often, particularly with the elderly, have a real need or desire to romanticize them and their experience and their diminishment, even though it can be one of the most brutal animal realities that we're ever going to encounter. I think it is so brutal an animal that we do try to gain distance by romanticizing it. And so occasionally you'll, you know, be in an old age home or in a hospice and somebody will speak like a snake with the truth about how they really feel about their child or the world or the person tending to them. And it is shocking to see the sentences that can come out of a sweet old woman's mouth, you know, for her caretakers, and I mean professional caretakers, and, you know, what, for instance, some of the nurses at hospices have to hear on a daily basis, incredible. So that, to watch that, and that often is not the responsibility either of the person who's suffering from dementia, but it's coming up from some soul in there, and that's, it's incredibly powerful and very animal to see.
You know, in talking about like dementia as revealing the core of a person or being a tripwire to the truth, do you sometimes think, though, that dementia distorts too, that sometimes it reveals somebody's inner core and sometimes it gets them to speak a truth that would have gone unsaid, but other times it really kind of contorts the truth and leads people to misinterpret a person's true nature or what they'd really want to say?
Oh, definitely. I think both things are true. And I think that that can be what's so difficult for a caretaker, is that you're trying to have a relationship with the person who is disappearing. So you're looking for that person in everything they say. Sometimes you're finding them. Sometimes you're finding something that may be revealing them as they disappear. In other words, if there's a tripwire to the truth within dementia, maybe you're going to hear something or something's going to be revealed that's going to give you one sharp look at something right before they disappear even farther. But also at the same time, maybe they're going to say something or do something that's very distorted and not at all realistic. And so was that thing that you felt had the ring of truth, was that truth or was that distortion? I think that that's part of the heartbreak of trying to still hold on to the person you knew as they're ultimately leaving, you know, mentally.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Alice Sebold. She's the author of the best-selling novel, The Lovely Bones, and her new novel is called The Almost Moon. Just for the record, I want to refer back to something I said a little earlier. I had attributed John le Carré with the quote that a writer has to have a chip of ice in his heart. And I think I heard John le Carré quote Graham Greene as having said that.
Okay, that makes sense to me, actually.
So just for the record. And then I think John le Carré said something like, when you're a writer, you're the kind of person who has to look in, like, when you're visiting somebody's house, you look in their medicine cabinet to see what's in there. Do you subscribe to that, too? There is this... You really do have to know everything, even if it kind of trespasses in some way. And it's going to come out in fiction, and some people will feel like you stepped on their toes, but there's no way around it if you really want to write honestly about the way life is.
I came up against that in a particularly difficult situation with a friend a few years ago, I was not the writer in the situation. They were the writer in the situation. Using material from somebody else's life in a way that I thought was not right. So I think that there are good ways of doing it and bad ways of doing it. The problem is that the writer is the one who is the ultimate person who decides whether it's a good way or not. It's very morally spongy ground. And again, you know, I do feel that in my particular case, at least so far, because I work a lot with family issues, have been lucky enough to have family members who respect the written word. And you know, that's not to say it's not difficult. But you just, it's either that or not write, in my mind, or to write things that don't try to get up close to the bone of truth. And I'm not interested in writing those things.
Why is family your main territory?
So far, it's, you know, I'm writing through my obsessions, and family is what shapes us. And, you know, I also think it's the most dramatic territory, though often not thought to be the case. It's where it all begins and ends for me. So I'm routinely drawn back to it.
You know, since parent-child relations are kind of at the center of your two novels, I'm wondering if you have any children.
No, I don't.
And was that a conscious decision of deciding that you didn't want to have children?
Yeah, it was. It was, I think, just never something that I used to say in my late 30s. I'm now 45, so I think, you know, time is pretty much, almost, the garage door is almost shut. But I think my whole 30s into early 40s, I kept saying to people, if the biological clock starts ticking, I'm available, I'll listen to it. But it just never did.
You mean you never felt?
Yeah, I never felt that desire to have children. I don't know whether that's because, I write and so I give my time to that or what it is, but it wasn't something that I was driven to do.
And since your new book is about, like, you know, an adult woman taking care of her elderly mother and then killing her, do you wonder, like...
Am I planning on doing that? Is that
the question? No. Do you wonder, like, when you get older, if you don't have children, who will help you? Who will be there when you're old? Do you think about that kind of thing?
I think everybody over a certain age does think about that. And you think about that when you're taking care of your own parents or worrying about their sicknesses. But also I would say this, as I've been reminded by my father-in-law a lot, having children is no guarantee that they're going to take care of you. So, you know, if that's the reason why you're having children, that's not a very good reason to have kids.
You had a really good piece in the New York Times in July, an op-ed about how you love to read books during the summer and how earlier in your life reading was a problem because you had undiagnosed dyslexia. And I just want to read a paragraph from that. You wrote, "I've reached an age where I can admit to and even take a strange sort of joy in what some might see as limits. I had an allergic reaction to Johnson's baby oil the first time I smeared it on my skin and went out into the backyard at 13. The feeling of sand on oil, like the feeling of newspaper when I crumble it in my hand, or the smell of brass on my fingers after using a stairwell, or turning a doorknob, unsettles me. My husband sarcastically calls me his delicate flower, but I am also the one who attends to an animal's corpse found under an overpass or empties the occasional sick person's bedpan. To me, it's simple. There is our world, the world of mundane annoyances, of heat and grit, and of hideous realities. And there is that other world I visit each summer, my real world, the world of fiction." I really love that paragraph, but I have to say, you know, you talk about fiction as like leaving the hideous realities, but you write about the hideous realities of life. So what kind of retreat is that?
I guess for me, it's when I read fiction, I don't go toward what I would guess would be classified as escapist fiction. So I do read, I just read a novel that is set in Africa where, you know, almost everybody in it by the end is either diagnosed or affected by the diagnosis of someone in Africa with AIDS. But I thought it was an amazing book. And it's the power of language to bring that experience to me at my home. And the novelist was a former war reporter, and she's brought back this hideous reality that she saw on a day-by-day basis and processed it through a novel and paid tribute and honored those people who did die that she saw. I think that's amazing. And you know, so that's where faith comes in, and that's where, you know, I just kind of stand in awe of the power of what reading and books can do.
But, you know, if you want to get away from the hideous realities of life, why are you drawn to writing about them?
Because I want to understand them. And I don't think ignorance is a way that you gain distance on something. I think understanding is the way you gain perspective and therefore can live among those hideous realities. You can live with them. And, you know, even like with in The Lovely Bones with her heaven, it was really about trying to have greater understanding. That was the gift of heaven. It wasn't, you know, all happiness and fluffernutter. It was really trying to understand things. That to me is what it's all about. So.
Now, you say you had an undiagnosed case of dyslexia when you were young, so you didn't become a reader until later in life. What changed that made it not only easier for you to read, but so essential for you to read?
I think probably feeling, you know, I felt alienated as a kid, as a lot of people do. But I think probably something that was very important is when I was raped and I realized that I had to be my best advocate, and I was 18 years old, and I saw that the adults around me, even the well-meaning adults, being, you know, the DAs, the ADAs, and then the not-so-well-meaning ones, the ones that were on the other side, that they would take control of that situation away from me and that I was just another rape case. So no one had as much of a vested interest in making that case go well as I did. And as opposed to some other victims that I would run into in the hallway or in the courthouse, I knew how to read. I knew what language meant. I knew, you know, how to form a sentence. And I knew that that had power. And so I think I became very aware of language as this hugely powerful force in a day-to-day way as well. And then that made me go back into reading in a way that reading wasn't something that snobby people did to shut me out, which is how I felt about it, I think, when I was growing up, but that it was a whole world that I had access into and that I could actually inhabit. So I saw it as something powerful after that rape experience, and it really realigned my relationship to it.
Did you have to take the stand at the trial of the man who raped you, and did language really help you make your case?
I think so. Yes, I did have to take the stand. And, you know, they have limited expectations for teenage rape victims in terms of how articulate you're going to be, whether you're going to speak in full sentences. So when you do those things, it makes a big difference. And I was aware of that.
My guest is Alice Siebold, and she's the author of the mega bestseller, The Lovely Bones. And her new novel is called The Almost Moon. Can I ask you to look back a little bit on the experience you had when The Lovely Bones started to take off as this phenomenon? What made it cross over to, like, mega bestseller? Was there any one thing?
I don't think there was any one thing. I do think that there were a variety of very powerful forces that kind of all converged. And I often think that the novelists themselves, they're the last person to really understand. I was so busy trying to, you know, do whatever my publisher wanted me to do, you know, go to what city or do what reading, that I really didn't look up until about 6 months after the book came out and it was still on the bestseller list. And that was the first time I realized that, you know, I was having a success. But I really kept my head down for so long that I wasn't really aware of it for a while.
I imagine that your advance for your new novel, The Almost Moon, was a lot larger than for The Lovely Bones, because who knew that it was going to take off that way. Did you find it intimidating to get this large advance, knowing that, like, if the new book doesn't sell really well, then the publisher is going to lose money? And, do you feel this, like, responsibility to have a best-selling book and to earn back the advance that you were given? Was that cramping when you were writing?
Well, let's talk about the good news, bad news situation, which is
yeah.
Lovely Bones was the first book of a two-book deal that I signed in 2000. So I didn't have a huge advance for The Almost Moon.
No.
So the good news about that is, no, I didn't feel any pressure to earn back an advance.
Well, that's really funny. Wow. Oh, so, well, I'm speechless when I think of the advance they would have given you for the second book. But maybe that did free you to write anything you wanted to, because this book might not be what the publisher was expecting.
Yeah, I don't think it was. And I'm not, I also just, at the time I signed the two-book deal, unpublished novelist, that was a good deal. And I'm not a revisionist. I don't go back and think that that was a bad deal just because Lovely Bones took off.
Well, Alice Siebold, thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Alice Siebold's new novel is called The Almost Moon. This is Fresh Air.